As a Coffee House Shots listener, you will be all too familiar with the headlines that have dominated the news cycle in the past month. Trump, tariffs, trade wars, stock market crashes, and general economic instability. It's during these periods of uncertainty that it's most important to have a steady hand guiding your finances. Charles Stanley Wealth Management understands the complexities of today's financial landscape. Their experienced financial planners and investment managers are here to help you navigate through the storm and provide peace of mind. For more information, visit www.charles-stanley.co.uk today to schedule a free, no-obligation call to discuss your situation. And remember, investment involves risk.
Hello and welcome to the special bank holiday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Michael Gove. This is the 25th anniversary of the landmark Irving versus Lipstadt libel case, where David Irving sued American academic Deborah Lipstadt after she accused him of being a Holocaust denier. Deborah joined us for this podcast alongside the lawyers who represented her, Anthony Julius and James Lipson, to provide her reflections on the trial and the intense media scrutiny at the time, on Holocaust denial more generally, and why the principles behind the case are even more important today, as we've been reminded this week, in a context of rising anti-Semitism. Deborah, 25 years on, what is the real historical significance of that trial and David Irving's defeat?
I think the main significance is the body of material that we amassed due to the decision to assemble this dream team of historians. And for the first time ever, a group of top-notch historians sat down and demolished the arguments of Holocaust deniers based on the documents. It was the only time it was done. Prior to that, we just assumed this is rubbish. But nobody had ever tracked their footnotes, and because it was a useless task. It was like rolling the rock up the hill, but we did it, and I think that's the historical significance of the trial itself.
And Holocaust denial as a phenomenon seems a curious one. It's one of the biggest historical facts of the 20th century, one of the biggest stains on humanity. Why is it, do you think, that there have been, and indeed continue to be, people who try to diminish the significance, if not deny altogether, the agency of the Nazis?
Holocaust denial, it's a mistake just to think of it as a distortion of history. At its heart, it's a form of anti-Semitism, classic anti-Semitism, because it argues the Jews are involved and continue this conspiracy to compel Germany and all of the rest of the civilized world to acknowledge this horrible thing that happened that never happened. They do it for their own gain, and they're so powerful that they were able to force Germany to accept the mantle of having committed this terrible crime. So it fits right into, if it didn't fit right into the format of anti-Semitism and the modus operandi of anti-Semitism, I think it would have died.
And of course, it's a historical idea or virus that needs to be countered. But a court of law is a curious place to have an historical debate. And Anthony, how important do you think it was that in the majesty of an English courtroom, that these issues were not just debated, but decided?
Well, it gives the historical record a kind of legal endorsement. In the ordinary way, one wouldn't expect historical arguments to be fought out in court in any kind of productive or constructive way, because historical inquiry operates according to its own internal dynamic, and it's not the same as a forensic investigation in the context of court proceedings. But of course, as with the recent Supreme Court decision on the trans question, when judges weigh in, what they say has the authority of the state and not just the academy, and exercises its own persuasive power.
Did you worry that by giving Irving this platform, by allowing him to appear in court, that he was able to, in a way,
use the court in order to put forward his ideas and to defend his record in a way that might potentially have given succor or encouragement to people who shared his ideology and views.
It wasn't really a worry because it wasn't really, it was never an opportunity not to do that. It was Irving, remember, who brought the case against Deborah. And so other than accommodating Irving and settling with him, he was always going to have that platform. And also having started the inquiry, the platform we knew was going to be a platform that served Deborah's interests and vindicated what she had written rather than served his interests. So we were confident that the platform would not be a platform that would embellish his reputation.
And there was a period in his career when Irving, if not fated, was considered to be a significant revisionist historian. But at the end of the case, obviously, his reputation was in ruins. Were there any worries that you had, that given that there were some historical figures who might not have agreed with him, but certainly considered him to be a formidably powerful writer, that he might actually be capable of advancing some arguments in the courtroom that would win, if not approval, at least assent from others?
At the start of the case, when we appointed our first expert, which was Professor Richard Evans, he also had made that point. He said he has a residual reputation as a revisionist, and we're not going to be able to establish what you need us to establish, which is that he's a liar, essentially, and he's not a historian. And that reputation was based on his first book about the bombing of Dresden and his big book on Hitler's War, the first edition of that, where, as you say, he had that reputation as a revisionist. But as soon as you started looking into the second edition of Hitler's War, you could see that revisionism had turned into something else. It turned into plain denial, distortion, lying, etc. And then in our inquiries, we went back to the beginning of his career. We went back to the bombing of Dresden book. And actually, he had started off not as a revisionist, but just as a liar. And although he had a reputation for being able to find archival material, that source material that other people couldn't find, and was a very good German speaker, he abused that material from the very beginning of his career.
And Deborah, how did it feel to be physically in court with a man who was, to all intents and purposes, pro-Nazi?
Pro-Nazi and anti-Semite, contemptuous of me, an American, a woman. He's a misogynist as well. It was very strange sitting, 10 feet from him, and with all the my lords and, the free priest suits and other things, it was gutter anti-Semitism that you heard from him in the most benign and benignest, even the formal of settings. And then on top of it, these two gentlemen, Anthony and James, had compelled me, and I accepted their instruction to keep silent, which for me was an unnatural act. So it was a very strange experience.
And it must also have been strange subsequently to see the whole case turned into a movie with Rachel Weisz playing you. How did you feel about that?
Well, now when I walk into a room, I feel that some people are going to be disappointed because they expect Rachel Weisz to walk in. That was also very strange, seeing it on the screen. I have a friend, she's now 14, but when the movie came out, she was about 4 or something like that, maybe. And she thinks the trailer for the movie was the movie. She wanted to watch my movie, the 90 seconds, whatever. And she kept asking, why does that woman sound exactly like you? So I guess Rachel nailed the accent.
And of course, the historical fact of the trial, the movie afterwards, all of these things underline the significance that it would have appeared that an historical controversy had been settled. The truth of the Holocaust had been established in the most rigorous way. But actually, Holocaust denial and anti-Semitism, they're viruses which are very difficult to vaccinate society fully against. And since then, in the 25 years since then, where do you believe anti-Semitism and Holocaust denial have recurred, and why?
The why is a hard question. You properly use the word virus, and now we are after COVID, and it's even before, but certainly since COVID, we recognize how viruses can adapt and mutate. And anti-Semitism is a virus in that sense. It adapts and it mutates, moves from the right to the left. It moves within different religious, different political settings. I don't think any of us walked out, certainly not the three people around this table, the three of us this morning, thought that anti-Semitism was finished. What we did think was that hardcore kind of denial, the David Irving kind of denial, was done. And by and large, it was. I mean, there were people who before the trial, as Richard Evans said, as James just referred to earlier, he still had a residual reputation. And there would be people who would say, well, I don't, of course the Holocaust happened, but maybe Irving has a point. Maybe there weren't as many people, or maybe, you know, maybe it wasn't as bad, et cetera. And I think the trial amongst people with the least bit of common sense now recognize that not to be true. Though it's back to a certain amongst far right wingers, not historians, not people with any sense of history. It's still there.
And James, in the course of the work and the preparation for the trial, were there thoughts that occurred to you about why Irving had gone down this path and the influence that he'd had on others? Did you come to any conclusions about why this virus can be so contagious in certain communities?
The psychology of Irving was an interesting examination and hard to understand any anti-Semite or extremist. But he craved attention and he craved respect. And he had not been to university. He craved the respect of the academy. He thought he would gain that by his own endeavors, but never got it completely and never got it to his satisfaction, and found respect and adulation actually in far right audiences, and found himself traveling into company that I don't think he really enjoyed keeping to begin with, but found that to be his home. And so his conversion, as it were, was at a moment where there was this very strange man called Fred Leuchter, who had was an expert in death by electric chair and had gone to Auschwitz and had done a bogus report on the gas chambers and published something called the Leuchter Report. And Irving seized on that as the moment, and it was his real conversion into denial. And I don't think he ever liked that company completely, but it was the company that adulated him, and that's where he found himself. And to those people, he was an intellectual leader.
And he simultaneously wanted the respect of the historical establishment and the adulation of far-right thugs.
Well, he wanted the respect and adulation of the establishment, never got it.
No.
And found respect and adulation with far-right thugs. And just that's where he ended up.
And Anthony, you've written about anti-Semitism overall, and it's surprising, it would seem, that you have someone like Irving who clearly had some intellectual gifts. And you have people in literature, most famously T.S. Eliot, one of our greatest poets in the English language, who was also captivated by anti-Semitic tropes and so on. How can it be the case that apparently intelligent people get drawn into this conspiracism and this prejudice?
Well, I think you're paying far more credit to Irving than he deserves to put him in the company of T.S. Eliot. Mm. So I mean, let's make a distinction. That Eliot's interest in anti-Semitism as a poet was in the kind of material resources that anti-Semitism represented for a poet who was interested in exploring the limits of the language. So there was something amoral, non-moral about his engagement with anti-Semitism in his poetry, and it made for a very interesting aesthetic experiment with highly problematical moral implications. But it's something which is worth studying. Mm. Irving is not worth studying. The great Viennese satirist asked about Hitler in the 1920s responded, "On the subject of Hitler, nothing occurs to me." The point being that as a matter of kind of one's own cerebral hygiene, one has to step back from pondering with any real trouble the mental processes of certain kinds of very low-grade people. Irving, as Jane says, was a narcissist seeking publicity and with a kind of grievance against the world, which found its expression in anti-Semitism. And in a sense, that's it. The appeal of anti-Semitism to people, it has very diverse appeal, and that's precisely its attraction. It can capture the imagination of ranges of people for their own motives. And it presents a challenge to Jews and others to deal with.
Just to jump in here, but and you seem to suggest that because he seemed to be an intelligent person, I think that's open to debate, but that he would be immune to anti-Semitism. You know, there were Einsatzgruppen, the mobile killing units, and the heads of those units, three of them had PhDs. One had two PhDs in law and I think in politics. And one was a minister. You know, you can be, and the university professors, I mean, the most famous is Heidegger, but yep. Heidegger was hardly alone, gravitated to the Nazis. As someone I know used to say, you can be a PhD and an SOB at the same time without any.
And that's one of the curious things, that the automatic assumption would be that the most ardent Nazis were thugs. Are certainly people who were motivated by crude and atavistic prejudice. But as you say, there are people like Ohlendorf and Six, and of course Heidegger, Carl Schmitt, and so on. So you had people who were, like Ohlendorf and Six, leading the Einsatzgruppen, who were intellectuals. And then you had people who were some of the most gifted minds of their time, who were lending their intellectual weight to the elimination of a whole people. And
but why does that surprise? Why does it? It's such an intellectualist fallacy.
Yes.
To think that intelligent people, and still more that distinct sociological category of intellectuals, are in some sense resistant to anti-Semitism, which actually represents a kind of appeal to a certain kind of intellectual engagement.
And what is that appeal? Because there've been various attempts
to make sense of the world. The anti-Semite understands, so he believes, how the world works. Understanding how the world works is itself an intellectual enterprise. So in that sense, anti-Semitism is almost designed for intellectuals. It represents a series of shortcuts, true, and there is no truth in it. But nevertheless, it exists in a particular form that has maximum appeal to intellectuals.
And if we move to the current day, we've seen anti-Semitism flourish in at least three different types of environment. So there is continuing anti-Semitism in parts of the Arab and Muslim world amongst Islamists. And you see that in the way in which, for example, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, an obvious forgery, is available in bookshops in some parts of the Arab world. It's also the case that there have been some people on the very radical left who've appropriated anti-Semitism. And this, of course, has been an issue very close to your heart, Deborah. Universities like Columbia and others have seen not just campus radicalism, but academics flirting with or indeed embracing anti-Semitic positions. And, of course, we've also seen a revival of anti-Semitism on the far right. In some of the comments that you hear from people on the far right of Austrian and German politics, but increasingly on the far right in America as well, with COD or popular historians playing with all sorts of tropes that one would have thought would have been in the trash can of history. Why do you think that in each of these three areas, and I'll ask James and Anthony as well, that there's been this both persistence and indeed revival?
Well, you know, I used to talk about a political spectrum from far right to far left in terms of anti-Semitism. I no longer do that. I talk about a horseshoe. And the two extremes of the horseshoe, far left and far right, meet and share the same tropes and the same hostilities. And what I find most fascinating is you think that if I'm on the far left or someone is on the far right, and we both share this hatred or blaming of Jews, holding Jews responsible, we would have different modes of talking about it. But it's the same. It's the same tropes. It's the same. It's the same symbolism. It's the same way of thinking. And so they come together and they share it. It helps them make sense of a world that they. It gives them someone easy to blame, and to some degree, it makes them feel like they're brave enough to speak an unacceptable truth.
And Anthony, do you think that there's been a particular recrudescence or revival, a new dark energy in anti-Semitism, whether it's on campus or on the political far right?
I think there was a period after the Second World War when anti-Semitism, I mean, really, once we talk about anti-Semitisms rather than anti-Semitism, for versions of the hatred of mistrust of Jews, was in retreat. It was in retreat partly because of the fact of the Holocaust becoming a matter of public knowledge, and partly also, certainly in Western Europe and the States, of a kind of stabilization of politics, a consequence of the Cold War, the continuing kind of petrification of political conflict. So that's now past, and anti-Semitism, so to speak, has warmed up again.
Mm.
I don't think that anti-Semitism is a phenomenon only of the far right and the far left. It's a deformation of every political ideology, including centrist ideologies. The anti-Semitism of the liberal center of the French Revolution.
Mm.
Everything for the Jews as individuals, nothing for the Jews as a people, was the slogan of the centrists in revolutionary times, in revolutionary France. That's to say, a resistance to what was regarded as collective claims by Jews. Jews are a provocation to the imagination of the political ideologist, left, right, and center, because of the way that they elude in their self-understanding the ordinary categories of political thinking. And that's a foundational problem in the engagements of the Jews and Judaism with politics, in the understanding of people on the political side of the engagement. So anti-Semitism is going to be with us. It has returned, and it's only a comfort for centrists to think that it's other people's problems and not their own too.
As well as the anniversary of that case, it's also the anniversary of the end of the Second World War, the liberation of Bergen-Belsen. And as we reflect on that, the voices of Holocaust survivors are inevitably fading. How important do you think this moment is? And as we remain vigilant about anti-Semitism, how important is Holocaust memorial and remembering?
I think it's very important. History always passes.
Mm.
You know, recently I visited, I've done it many times, the African American History Museum, a magnificent museum in Washington, D.C. on the Mall. And I often, as I walk through it, I mean, there were diaries left and letters left by enslaved people, but very few filmed. I don't know of any filmed interviews. And we have, if they had been enabled to speak and listen and heard in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, we would have known so much more and gotten so much more on a personal level. But history passes. The survivors, the people who can speak in the first person singular, will always disappear because death comes and their lives end. And this makes this such a, as opposed to just the normal course of events, is, as Anthony alluded to a few moments earlier, that we have now the normalization of anti-Semitism, of people feeling that they're free to say certain things that they couldn't say before. We have the weaponization of anti-Semitism, the politicization of anti-Semitism, and that is very troubling, that it's coming at the same time. I know there are people who are annoyed by Holocaust memorials. I was recently interviewed by a major news outlet here in the United Kingdom. And it said, well, shouldn't we? I mean, it's become so rote. Shouldn't we stop having them? I said, no, not at all. You know, but it's now more important than ever. Because in the lifetime of people still alive on the face of this earth, there was a concerted attempt, not in what people used to talk about, and I put this in big quotation marks, darkest, you know, continent, but in the heart of Europe, in the heart of Christian Europe, in the heart of the enlightened Europe, to do away with an entire people in a systematic fashion. This is something that should never become boring, should never become rote, and should frighten us in the extreme.
Anthony, in the last few days, there's been a controversy around a pop group, we needn't name them, who were playing with Hamas and Hezbollah imagery. And they've said that this was done ironically.
You believe them?
Well, I myself don't. But the curious thing is, why should it be the case that three young men who are setting out to provoke and who have a particular political outlook, why is it that they should think that waving the iconography of what are clearly terrorist groups is fun.
I don't know. They apparently on the stage they shouting up Hamas, up Hezbollah, and then the PC plod says, "What were you doing?" And they respond, "Well, we absolutely do not endorse Hamas or Hezbollah, on advice from our lawyers." So, but these are just kids, aren't they? They're just provocateurs. So I think probably the best thing to say about them is to say nothing really, yes, about them.
But it does show that normalization.
Quite. And in that regard, what advice would you give to politicians, to academia, to lawyers, to journalists, to anyone who's helping to shape public debate about the challenge of anti-Semitism now? Because, of course, there are many people who are concerned about the conflict in Gaza, and there are many people who will have criticisms of the response of the Netanyahu government, but who will also be very wary about allowing criticism of a state and its leader to elide into a broader revival of old prejudices. So what general advice would
you
give? Look,
I think it's very important to acknowledge, and it seems extraneous to have to acknowledge it, but criticism of the policies of the state of Israel is not anti-Semitism. If that were the case, the hundreds of thousands of Israelis who are in the street every Saturday night would be anti-Semites, and of course that's ludicrous. Israel is a democracy, a struggling democracy, as so many other democracies, but you can freely criticize. But as you also say, and properly so, it leads into anti-Semitism too often, or anti-Semitic tropes are used. And it's very important to recognize, for the critics who would call that out, when is it something said that you might not like, but it's not anti-Semitism, and when is it anti-Semitism? You know, Chicken Little, "Dear me, the sky is falling." When it really falls, nobody pays attention. I think it's very important to differentiate between that.
And Anthony, any guidance that you would give to people as they navigate these debates?
Guidance? What you mean, guidance to people who want to condemn Netanyahu without...
Guidance overall in trying to ensure that there are some principles or some broad points to bear in mind.
Oh, I see.
So that that we don't allow anti-Semitism to corrode proper debate.
Well, I think two things. I think, first of all, there is no substitute for educating oneself. So people who face the accusation that their language is anti-Semitic should take the trouble to actually read a bit about anti-Semitism and actually understand what it's all about, rather than immediately responding by accusations of bad faith against the people who raise that question. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I think it's probably for those people worth them listening, at any rate, to the criticisms that are made of them, and considering their provenance and the fears and anxieties that motivate them. Jews are not unreasonably, as we lawyers say with understatement, anxious about Jew hatred, and they have good reason to be. And when they express those anxieties, they should be listened to with some respect and understanding. So take seriously what's said and study the history of anti-Semitism. Those are the two pieces of advice I would give.
And finally, apart from your own work, Deborah, and your own work, Anthony, if you were recommending to someone a book or books to help understand the historical record and indeed potentially infer from that some of the contemporary challenges, is there a particular book that you would recommend to our listeners?
Well, since I'm in the UK, I like David Baddiel's Jews Don't Count, or Jews Don't Count, is that the one?
Exactly.
Yes, because it shows and there's certain parts with which I disagree, et cetera, but that goes with every book, an academic. If you agree with the whole book, you haven't read it carefully. He shows the, for lack of a better word, the two-faced nature of so many people who stand so strong on prejudice when it comes to anti-Semitism. Oh, come on, it's just a joke. Oh, come on, why are you taking it so seriously? And I appreciated that his calling out, and the fact that he was calling out his compatriots, the people with whom he shared political views.
Anthony, anyone that you would recommend?
No, I just think there's no shortcut. I think one should just read as much as one can and form one's own judgment. I don't think there's a scriptural text that contains authoritative guidance on anything.
Anthony, Deborah, thank you.